Okay, let's begin. We've got an agenda of several bills. We're going to start with Senator Scheid, Senate File 2204.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. I received a letter, actually last year, from a constituent who has disability plates, a set of license plates for a car, but he has two cars that he drives. And for the other car, he just has the hanging tag. And since I have one of those myself, I know that once in a while you forget to hang it. And he wanted to be able to have a second set of disability plates, you know, for the other car. And obviously you pay for those. He's willing to do that. The department was concerned. The Driver and Vehicle Services Division rules didn't really allow them to do that, and they felt there would be expense in having that option for people. So I think we have dealt with that issue. If you see the first engrossment here, the State Council on Disability is going to approve the issuance of the second set, so it takes the department out of it, and obviously the person pays for the plates. But the department testified in the division that was fine, then they had no objection. So should not be a cost.
And Senator Scheid, do you have any sense of what usage there will be? Is there any guess?
You know, I've thought about it because I wondered in my own home where I could conceivably drive four cars, but I don't very often. No, I don't. And but maybe McCormick does. I don't know.
Ms. McCormick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, Pat McCormick, Director of Driver and Vehicle Services. And in discussions with our staff as well as with the Disability Council, they're estimating that this may be about one or two applications a year. They don't see this as being very common because the vehicles have to be retrofitted for the person with the physical disabilities. And so that isn't a common situation. And in the testimony in the Transportation Committee, the disabilities executive director spoke about the fact that she thought it would be very few, and she felt her staff was adequate to be able to handle the responsibilities.
Okay, thank you. Further questions for Senator Scheid?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Stumpf.
I'm sorry, I missed a little bit of your introduction, but could you just quickly explain the difference between the is the permit that hangs in your window, you know, like over your someplace in your car, what's the difference between that and the license plate?
Well, I think there is a difference, and I probably wasn't as aware of it as until just a moment ago, but I think that the plates go on the retrofitted vehicles, which many people, of course, who have the tag hanging don't have a need to do.
Mr. Chair and Senator Stumpf, the issue would be, yes, that the vehicle must be able to be driven by the person who is disabled, and the certificates are usually used for more of the temporary disabilities.
All right. Great. Thank you.
Further questions for Senator Scheid?
I'd move that.
Senator Stumpf.
No, I'd move the unless Senator Scheid, are you on this committee?
No.
Oh, no.
Okay. All right. Sorry.
Is there,
I'd move Senate File 2204 be recommended to pass. And re-referred to the floor.
I don't believe there's a division report. Senator Stump moves that Senate File 2204 be recommended to pass. Further discussion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you, Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, you were going fast there for a second. I think that it might be in the division bill, but I really, I'm not sure of that in their policy.
My question
bill.
Was whether or not there's a division report. Which
well, yeah, no, I know, but I mean, if it is in their policy bill, it's still okay to be moving. Yeah. Am I correct?
Apparently it is in what, the transportation policy bill, Senator Murphy? So, but that's fine, Senator Scheid.
Thank you.
All right, thanks.
Thank you, members.
Let's try Senator Messon. Nice to have you here. House File 3138.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. This is the State Labor Contracts Ratification Bill, House File 3183. This bill ratifies labor contracts and the compensation plans for the employees in the executive branch. 10 contracts and 5 compensation plans have been reviewed and approved by the LCC Subcommittee on Employee Relations. This is about an 8 or 9 month process where the negotiations are made, are held with all of these union groups and others. The average is about 3.25% for almost all of these contracts. There's some performance enhancement steps in some of the contracts. I can go through. Obviously, there's no new money. Today, we accounted for this money in the last session. And if it's not all accounted for, the departments have to come up with it anyway. So there is a provision I should make you aware of for the zoo director. We've got one of the top 10 zoos in the country. And of the top 15 zoos in the nation, every zoo director gets paid more than ours. So we added a provision in here where private money can be added to the base salary for the zoo director. This is not a issue that I take lightly, but we've got an excellent zoo director, and this allows some additional money from private sources. So with that,
Mr. Olson.
Mr. Chair, where is it indicated? I see. It is
Section 1.
Section 1, the deleted language removes the requirement that it may not exceed the salary of the governor, but then that was in current law that any amount exceeding 95% of the salary of the governor must that was the case before.
Yeah.
That if there was any wait a minute.
Does that remove it? Any amount, Senator
exceeding
Cohen, and
95% has to be
any amount us. Over that has to come from private sources. We've got we did a survey that is the 15th or 16th.
So Mr. Chairman, Senator Metzen, it lifts the cap of what non-state funds can go in terms of the total salary of the. Of the zoo administrator.
That's correct, yeah. Okay. And the study we did, there's of all the major zoos in the country, we are by far the lowest salaried executive director in the nation.
Senator Betzel.
Mr. Chair, we've got the House file before us. I don't know if the Senate language that went through the budget, State Government Budget Division is identical to what the House language is or not. And I know that Senator Metzen had another amendment he wanted to prepare to it. So, do we have Senate language to compare?
Senator Betzel, I'm not sure we've got the language, and I'm told that because the House file is different, we don't adopt the division report, but I'm not sure if we have the Senate language. But if we can wait till.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Watson.
Mr. Chairman, the Senate language is in the House file. It's everything up through subdivision 10 on the last page. The House file added 11 through 14, and Senator Metzen has an amendment to add a subdivision 15.
That's, I think that's correct. And the one we're adding is the one we just approved last week, and we have to put that in this bill. That's another minuscule addition that the LCC heard last week. So instead of going through all the hoops, we talked to the chair that Senator Thomasoni, wherever we went, there was a Betzel Senator Betzel. I visited with him, and he said we could skip that step just for that one contract, and he and I have talked about it. So,
and Mr. Chair,
but that's what we'll be adding later on.
Senator Olson.
And, Mr. Chair, the 11 through 14 are that the House is in the House language is another – those are contracts – that was represents contracts that the LCC Employee
approved.
Relations Subcommittee approved after the bills were initially introduced. That's happened during session.
I believe that's correct.
and Mr. Hibinger, let me just follow up on just out of curiosity. I had not been aware in work we've done before that the zoo director, the language relative to the zoo director's salary indicated that some of it was to be raised by non-state funds. Obviously, the zoo director is appointed by a board appointed by the governor, and I believe subject to Senate confirmation. So how many agencies – do we have that with any of the other board agencies? I'm just trying to think. The Arts Board is similar to the zoo board. Is there – what
– only what I'm aware of, isn't it?
Mr. Chair, I don't believe the Arts Board is covered by the agency head cap in Chapter 15A.
So how many – so do we have any other language relative to salary being paid by non-state funds?
I don't think so.
There aren't any others.
I don't believe that there are. And I said that in my initial remarks that I don't take this kind of a thing lightly. But in this instance, I think that we have to do it to keep the –
Yeah, I'm not objecting. I'm just – it's more a question of curiosity that it just struck me as – pretty unique language, and I guess it is pretty unique, Mr. Hubinger, if there's nothing else. So,
if you need
what's your curiosity, Mr. Appetz?
We have Mr. Appetz here.
I don't want to drive this into the ground, but what so is the board currently, as part of its outside fundraising, have they been able to supplement the salary of Mr. Eichten?
Mr. Chairman, John Appetz, I'm with the law firm of Messerly & Kramer. We represent the Minnesota Zoo Foundation, and the Zoo Foundation and the board have asked me to come forward with this request. I'll give you a quick bit of history. Back in 2001, the salary of the zoo director was set at roughly 95% of the salary of the governor, like many other executive salaries. This is a state agency, I think, as you're aware. One of the problems we were having then, our zoo director had left, and we were seeking a new zoo director, and were unable to bring in the person we were looking for because we just didn't have enough salary to compensate this person adequately. What happened at that point in time is the LCC brought forward a proposal to allow there to be outside sources of income, non-state monies, added to supplement the zoo director's salary. In part, this is because the zoo director also works raising money for the Zoo Foundation, which supplements our operating costs and operating expense. And as you know, some of our capital expense as well with the Minnesota Zoo Farm and other sorts of activities. So that happened in 1981. We have had sort of a static situation with that salary for about the last 5 years. And in fact, Mr. Chairman, this is a pretty narrow market, if you will, in terms of skills and qualifications, and our zoo director has been approached a number of times for opportunities elsewhere, not just within the country but worldwide, and is here, and the zoo board and the zoo foundation certainly want to do what they can to keep him, number one, and number two, make sure that if he were to depart, we would be able to attract the type of talent that we hope to do so. This is about, we've got a little list here that, that the chairman, that the president talked about in terms of a comparison of zoos of a similar size budget, and we're right at the bottom, Mr. Chairman. Second from the bottom, Fort Worth is the only other one that's below us.
Okay,
does that help at all?
Yeah, that's helpful to have the background. We'll also note that Mr. Eichten was originally a lawyer, but was able to do something much better with the law degree than some of us. So,
Mr. Emke, I believe you mean
I'm sorry, Mr. Emke.
He's not handicapped any longer, Mr. Chair.
Poor lawyer.
Okay.
Huh?
Well, again, with apologies, I was curious about that section and had not seen it before. Mr. Senator Metzen, go ahead.
If you want, we can go through quickly Subdivision 1 is an AFSCME Council 5 contract. This is, again, about 3.25. This deals with approximately 16,200 employees. Minnesota Association of Professional Employees, that's next. That's about 11,000 professional employees. That, again, is around that 3.25 range. There's some increases in steps in there. Subdivision, the next one is AFSCME Council 5, Unit 8. There's about 2,000 correction officers there in that area. The next one is also an AFSCME Unit 225. There's about 70 radio communications officers involved in that one. State Residential Schools Education Association is the next one. It's about 180 teachers. Next one deals with government engineers. There's about approximately 900 in that area. Middle management is next. There's about 2,800. Again, that's 3.25. And there's some steps there, too. The next one is a State Board of Investment Salary Administration Plan. That's 9 managerial people and executive director. Next one's a commissioner's plan. There's about 1,100 unrepresented employees in this category. That, again, is about 3.25. Goes on. There's a managerial plan. About, did I mention that? 1,260 employees. The next one is Minnesota Law Enforcement Association contract. That would be the state troopers, the conservation officers, and the BCA agents, which is about 720 employees. Interfaculty organizational, there's a 3144 full-time employee equivalents there. That's the state universities. There are some steps added, a couple catch-ups there, but there again, it's approximately the 3.25 plus some step increases. And there's a personnel plan for the MNSCU administrators. There's about 550 unrepresented managers in MNSCU, and that section deals with those folks. Subdivision 14 is the Office of Higher Education Compensation Plan. This only takes care of about 45 employees, but there again, that's 3.25. Average increase there, similar to all the other ones. The next one is Minnesota State College faculty contract. There's about 4,300 full-time equivalent employees there at the technical colleges. There again, I believe that's about 3.25 also. Does that complete them except for, and the last one we did last week, the one I referred to earlier, was a state college faculty labor agreement. I believe that, is that also, Mr. Ubinger, about 3.25 with some lane changes and a little more? But that's the one we just did, that the only one that, well, what the LCC, but we did bypass with the consent of the chair, Senator Betzel, on this one because we just didn't have the time, and it's pretty equivalent to all the other ones, so we thought it'd be all right to bring it here. And did you have any more to add on that one? So that essentially is the bill. It's obviously it's not new money. It's money we approved, in the past here. And if in some cases it goes just a little bit higher, that comes out of the system. So.
Senator Roebling.
Thank you. And I'm wondering about that it's mostly, that it's close to what we approved in the past, which we approved 3% last year. But when you look at this, it actually, with the lane changes, is almost 6%, 5.88%. And for the biennium, from the amount paid 2 years ago to this current biennium, it will be a 9.4% increase. So I don't think we budgeted that much. I mean, I don't remember carrying that much in our budget for salary increases. So even, I mean, is that always figured in, that if we're giving a 3% increase, we're figuring in all the lanes and steps and everything else that comes with it, and that was included in last year's budget?
Chairman, I'll let Mr. Hubinger take a shot at that. But
Mr. Hubinger?
Mr. Chair and Senator Roebling, the costing also always includes all of the across-the-board increases and lane changes and performance-based increases. So that 5.88% is the total cost of the increases for this biennium. You're correct in pointing out that the impact, when you annualize those costs so that employees receive those increases in the base, that it will have an impact of 9.4% on the next biennium. When the biennial budget proposal is developed for the next biennium, that will have to be taken into account.
Okay. For the Senator Betzel.
Mr. Chair, to sort of reinforce a bit of what Senator Roebling had pointed out, last year we did have the 3% salary supplement, and this came in at 3.25%. And I've heard this bill every step of the way from the LCC forward, and we've been told repeatedly this is going to come out of the agency's base to pay for it. So just so people are aware that what we appropriated didn't quite cover what the gap is here, but this is what they negotiated.
And Senator Betzel, you know, obviously last year when we were preparing the budget, we took that into account, and targets for divisions were established based upon the assumption of that 3%. Even if the negotiation was slightly above, we still probably took care of almost all of it with the targets for the agencies established last year. Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The issue, though, is that we really, you know, some of the agencies last year didn't get their what they were requesting. And so when they have to, and now this year we're cutting them further, 4%. So I just think that this is going to result in a lot of job losses. And during a time in the economy when we don't want to increase unemployment, I just think that we're going to see a lot of state employees losing their jobs. Well, some employees get 6% increases, or almost 7%, others will be jobless. And I just really question if that's the way we should manage. I know, you know, I guess the unions are, you know, they're supposed to be looking out for their own members, but I wonder how they take that into account, that a lot of their members are likely to lose their jobs with the passage of this increase and the decrease in the state revenues. And, you know, it's kind of an unfortunate situation that we have a decrease in revenues right now, but it's something that none of us can do a whole lot about with the economy as it is. But I just hate to contribute to the increase in the unemployment rate.
I'm not sure I agree that there's nothing we can do, but be that as it may, that becomes a little bit rhetorical. Certainly what the agencies have been able to do in the past in such situations is work through normal attrition, and obviously I assume the agency heads are making preparations for not only a difficult budget this year but next year. And I recognize that what you suggest is of concern to all of us. Do we pass the contracts and ratify the contracts? As I mentioned in discussion with Senator Betzold, we took that into account last year. Obviously, with agency cuts, there might be some difficulty. You know, the language in the bill we passed on Friday directs agencies to look at consulting contracts, to take a look at non-essential travel. And we hope that agencies can look at some of those kinds of expenditures without laying off employees. But I recognize it's difficult, although I at the risk of being a little bit political, I'll note that everybody at this table received a $20 increase in per diem payments. And I'm not sure how many people at this table turned that down. And I haven't heard any suggestions from this table or anybody else in the Senate that either we roll that back. Nobody seems to be rushing into the majority leader's office or my office making that request. I haven't seen anybody suggest we, through attrition, decrease the Senate to maybe 63 people to make up for that. And Senator Oberlin, so I appreciate your concern. It's striking that the concern you show for the state employees. I haven't heard anybody suggest that we ought to do something different differently for us.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, could you just clarify your comments on the budgeting for each of these departments? Does the base budget account for existing contracts involving the step movements? Is that incorporated into the base budget? So when we are talking about a 3% increase, we're talking about 3% on the overall change, so that you can't really compare that 3% to the overall projected increase in the salaries that Senator Roebling raised.
It doesn't project dollar for dollar, but what we did last year is, in setting budget targets for each of the conference committees, we, to the dollar, factored in a 3% increase, knowing that the negotiations would end up, in all likelihood, somewhere around that ballpark, give or take.
Okay, so, Mr. Chairman, increase over what? Over what had been paid the previous year, or what the contract would drive? If nothing had been renegotiated, people's salaries would have still gone up because of the structure of their contracts. They would have still advanced. Is the base considered on what it would have been advanced, and then 3% on top of that, or was it 3% based on what the payroll had been the previous year?
Well, it was 3% on top of that, to the extent that on top of what the base had been, to the extent that the agencies projected in their budget request to the legislature, the agencies projected that type of increase,
okay.
And we went beyond that.
Okay.
Now, can I say that agency to agency that was reflected dollar for dollar? No, I mean, not exactly, but certainly within the targets. We took that 3% figure, factored it in.
Right, I understand that.
If some agency decided they needed to hire another 10 people for IT purposes subsequent to the adjournment of the session, something like that would not be factored in.
Yeah.
But we tried to be pretty careful about that. I think Senator Roebling's point is certainly a good one, to the extent that, the passage of the bill last week, hopefully on the floor tomorrow, certainly we start once again imposing on these agencies, which has been going on now for a decade off and on.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Stump.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a little different question, or actually there's two questions. On the health insurance proposal that's been negotiated, and I'm not sure if you're the one to ask, but the Blue Plus dental plan is no longer available. What is the Blue Plus dental plan? I think the plan that we end up getting is Delta Dental. And it's not really a lot of dentists complain that even the Delta Dental isn't very, it doesn't cover the much of the cost. But what is the Blue Plus, and what happened in that plan to be dropped?
Mr. Chair and Senator Stump, I can talk about that just a little bit. Delta Dental was one of the products that was provided by Blue Cross Blue Shield, and there was limited participation in that product, as I understand it. And so Blue Cross decided not to continue providing it. Participants in that program had a choice of one of the other two plans, the one provided by Health Partners and then the Blue Cross Standard Program, or Delta Dental, sorry. and they had to choose. And I'm not aware of the difference in. I believe that the benefit set is about the same, but I don't know what the reimbursement rates are at.
Okay. The other question I have is under the subdivision 1 and 2, when we talk about AFSCME and we talk about the professional employees, about half of them are at the top of their range and cannot receive any additional increases from the steps. Is that correct? And so consequently, how do we encourage these employees to
stay there
and you know, and I'm sure these are some of our longtime employees that probably have a lot of experience and years of service. It seems to me that we're taking quite a number. AFSCME, I believe, is about 16,200, so half of those, and MAPE, 11,400, half of those, roughly 45% of those. So what is the encouragement for those employees? Are there other ways of compensating those?
Mr. Chair, Senator Stumpf, the state workforce is a relatively experienced one, and across all of the bargaining units, across almost all of them, at least half of the workforce is at the top of their salary range. Even those employees at the top of their ranges receive the across-the-board increases, so all of them will receive the 3.25% each year. And so they do receive increases in their salaries. They're also eligible for performance increases or one-time increases in the form of achievement awards for their recognized superior work on a particular program or project.
And what's the percent? Is it the 1% for performance?
Mr. Chair and Senator Stumpf, achievement awards are either take one of two forms, either a percentage increase in pay or a lump sum payment. It's usually 1% of pay or a lump sum of about $1,500. That's limited to about 40% of the employees in any particular bargaining unit.
Okay.
Chairman, I just might add, I know labor was mentioned a couple times at the desk here or somewhere, but this was negotiated, obviously, from the current administration, so I didn't do it, so it was done through...
We weren't trying to blame you, Senator.
No, but I wanted to make it clear that we're ratifying what administration and labor, if you will, worked on, not something that Senator Betzel and I put together, or Senator Cohn and I. It's been worked on for 8 or 9 months, and that's how it gets... Okay. That's what we're ratifying, work that was done by administration and the bargaining units.
Okay. Further questions for Senator Metz? And I believe we've got the A1 amendment.
Oh, yes,
Senator Higgins, I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to go back to the dental coverage for a bit. If you have anything other than, you know, your twice a year cleaning and checkup, our dental coverage is totally inadequate, as is, I think, most public employees. If you have a root canal, if you have a crown, you're going to pay out-of-pocket costs of far more than what our dental insurance covers. I have dental insurance from my other job as well. I had a root canal and a crown last fall. I blew through ours, I blew through theirs, and I wrote a check almost as large as well. And my dentist is probably no different than anybody else's dentist. And I have coworkers, other employees here in state government who have told me, they just have their teeth pulled rather than going through that whole process. That's unacceptable. So at some point, we need to start talking to Delta Dental about getting that coverage increased, because we're not doing our employees much of a favor at all if they have anything other than just your basic cleaning and checkup twice a year.
Well, Senator Higgins, I appreciate that. We can, without trying to be flip, we can talk to Delta Dental all we want.
We have to pay for it.
Yeah, but
yeah.
until we
oh,
have
I understand.
The money to... Senator Fredrickson.
Mr. Chairman, I just had comments on two or three items that have been discussed. One, I agree with Senator Higgins about the level of our dental insurance. Our dental insurance essentially just makes the dentists in my district angry when they look at the reimbursement. Some of them will not even participate in our plans anymore. That includes Delta Dental. And I agree with Senator Metzen that these are negotiated agreements. Over the years, I've watched the state negotiators as they negotiate these contracts, and I think we have some excellent negotiators for the interests of the state. They're done in the executive department with the in conjunction with the affected commissioners, and I think they've done a really good job of negotiating contracts in good faith with our employee unions. And then segue to something you said about our own salaries, Mr. Chairman. I don't think our legislative salaries have been raised probably for
1999.
10 years or more, years. Somewhere back 10 or 11 years since there were an increase in our legislative salaries.
A friendly amendment.
Per diems that we raised.
Friendly amendment.
Just recently done my income tax with my tax preparer. He told me that the latest figures from the Minneapolis-St. Paul area for legislators and other employees living more than 50 miles from the from our place of work, which is the capital for us, is $186 a day, and our per diems are 96. So until you get above $186 a day, they're not regarded as income, but they are regarded as reimbursement for expenses or compensation.
Mr. Chair?
Course of our employment.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Frederickson, are you including your housing allowance? Is housing included on the expense side but not on the income side in your statement?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, housing is a vouchered expense, and that would be included in the $186 cap.
Senator Foley.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've had the health through Delta Dental for as long as I've been a state employee, and what started out as a little higher paid has leveled off, and the amount of coverage is not great. I mean, yes, you get some prophylactic treatment where they do X-rays and examine those things, but the overall root canals and those more serious things, they only pay a small portion of it. But on the other hand, the overall rate for Delta Dental has never been that high. So if you're not satisfied with what benefits you get, I would suggest that you look at ways to increase the coverage for those that that want to spend the money to do that.
Well, again, if we have the money, that's the problem we face. So anybody else like to say anything else about root canals or
No, we don't like talking about it.
Or have we about had it with that?
Do that on the side.
If you've ever had one, Mr. Chair, they're really, really important to you.
I had one about 20 years ago. So
only one, you're lucky.
Okay, if we're off.
Chairman, we do have the A1 amendment, the last one to, that we should be ratified, so that should be added to the bill.
Okay, has that been distributed? Okay, we have the A1 amendment in front of us. Senator Metzen has discussed it. Is there further discussion on the amendment? If not, Senator Metzen moves adoption of the A1 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion carries. Senator Betzel.
Chair, Senator Metzen, you had some language regarding the legislative auditor's office, and I thought you were going to try to roll that.
What did we do with that?
That was a separate bill that you had.
Isn't it in the omnibus appropriations bill?
Okay, why don't you tell that to
Mr. Hubinger.
Mr. Chair, Senator Betzold, perhaps Mr. Watson can respond. Was that language included in the omnibus appropriations bill for the legislative auditor separate compensation plan?
Mr. Watson.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Hubinger, yes, I believe it is in the supplemental bill.
Okay, that's an excellent question. We'll make sure that it's there. If not, we could probably try to add it on the floor or something, but that's
right.
A good point.
I thought the plan was to
put it in this bill. I'm not sure what we agreed on, but we did agree on doing it. I do know that. So with that, if we could move this bill, if that's
okay. Senator Mintzen moves that House File 3138, as amended, be recommended to pass. Further discussion on that motion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No. Motion carries.
Thank you very much.
And the next bill is Senate File 3331, Senator Dibble. This is we started to have some discussion about this last Friday. This is the bill that Senator Higgins had presented. Senator Anderson wanted the opportunity to hear it. I don't know, Senator Anderson, if you've had a chance to talk to Senator Dibble or Mr. Rice about the issue.
Well, Mr. Chair, we had a hearing on it in my committee yesterday and passed it out
okay.
of our committee, out of the division, excuse
okay.
me.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Before we begin, Senator Anderson moves adoption of the division report. It's being distributed right now.
Thank you.
And then I'm going to ask Senator Frederickson to chair the committee for a couple minutes. Okay, we've got the division report. Senator Anderson moves adoption of the division report. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And I think you might have a committee engrossment. The only difference between the bill and the committee engrossment is insertion of the word public, so that we're stating that this is for public park purposes. Very quickly, members and Mr. Chair, apologies for the slight confusion the other night as you were going through the finance bill. I wasn't aware that Senator Anderson was going to pull the bill up for hearing at that moment, and as soon as we heard that, we had the amendment withdrawn, so we weren't trying to pull a fast one on Senator Anderson. So we had a nice hearing last night, and everything is in order. This bill has to do with land owned by the Minneapolis Park and Recreation Board, as well as a strip on the north side, in which it has an easement interest adjacent to the 35W bridge over the Mississippi. It's on the riverfront. And MnDOT is rebuilding the bridge, of course, and building it larger than the original, so its footprint is expanding. And so it has it is taking by condemnation that land and that interest. And I think there's a map coming around as well. So I think yours is on white paper, not green. And so what this bill asks to do is to allow the Park Board to make use of those funds, which would otherwise revert to the state's general fund because this land was originally acquired with state bond proceeds, to retain that money for the same purposes which it was originally intended, to acquire land along the Mississippi riverfront that would become a part of the regional parks system. Just very quickly, in case there's any confusion, Minneapolis Park Board versus regional park system, there is no such thing as a Metropolitan Council Park entity per se. The regional park system is comprised of park land that's owned and operated by 10 different park agencies throughout the metropolitan area. The Minneapolis Park and Recreation Board owns and programs a great deal of that regional park system by virtue of its location and the amount of parkland that's in Minneapolis. So big parts of the Minneapolis Park and Rec Board are part of the Metropolitan Park system. And so what would happen with these funds, rather than revert them back to the general fund, they simply be retained in Minneapolis by the Minneapolis Park and Rec Board for the purpose of keeping the regional park system whole. With that, Mr. Chair and members, Brian Rice is here from Minneapolis Park and Rec Board who can provide some more information.
Who's chairing? Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the map that you sent out, is the area to be condemned, the shaded? There's two shades, and there's one that says TE. What does TE mean?
Mr. Chairman, Brian Rice, Minneapolis Park Board. Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, TE is temporary easement, and it's the lighter shaded area that's going to be acquired by the state through the condemnation proceeding, and that's about a little over an acre of land. The temporary easement is while they're doing construction work.
And Mr. Chair.
We've got
forgot to mention the total amount that this property is valued at that would either revert to the state or come or stay with the Park and Rec Board on the Riverfront is about $740,000.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman and members, we've heard this provision several times in other committees, and I think what Mr. Rice and Senator Dibble are doing here is right on target, and I would move the bill when appropriate.
Any further questions for Mr. Chairman, if I could just make a comment. Bridge collapse was, quite tragic on August 1st. The Park Board does own a lot of land around this area, and I'd just like to say for the record, in working with MnDOT on the reconstruction, we gave them access to Bohemian Flats for the bridge where they laid that out. We've worked very cooperatively with them. We're not contesting the condemnation. They've been very good about it. Within days, even though it would have been our right under 4F of the Federal Highway Administration Act, we could have objected and tried to do it. But we've worked closely with them. They've been a good partner. They've expedited this. We've made our land available to them, and we sincerely appreciate their help, and we would certainly appreciate the legislature allowing us to basically not lose parkland. We'd take this money, and under the bill, we would replace it with other land along the river. So thank you for your help, Senator Murphy.
Question for Senator Dibble.
Senator Hickens can. It's her park.
Mr. Chair, I move that whatever this bill number is, that one, be recommended to pass.
Senator Hickens has moved that Senate file number 3331 be
sure.
All those in favor of the motion indicate by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you, Senator.
You will. Senator Anderson,
thank you.
Move adoption of the division report.
I would so move, Mr. Chair.
Senator Higgins has moved the adoption of the.
Higgins.
Sure, I will.
I think I just moved it, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, did I say Higgins?
I'm on.
Senator
yeah.
Anderson has moved adoption of the division report. All those in favor of that motion indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The division report is adopted. Senator Anderson.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Senate File 2492 is the LCCMR budget recommendations for the 2008 legislative session. As you'll recall, members, the LCCMR process has been changed to a one-year process, which is why you see me here. You've seen me here for the last 2 years in a row presenting recommendations. And the total amount of trust fund dollars available this year for allocation by the legislature are $22.866 million, and this bill also includes $86,000 recommended appropriation from the Great Lakes Protection Account. The bill, you have a packet in front of you that gives you some summary information about what's in the bill, and let me go through that briefly and then briefly go through the sections of the bill. And just for members' information, there are four out of the five Senate members of the LCCMR are on this Finance Committee. Senator Vickerman chairs it from the Senate side, Senator Fredrickson, Senator Parisot, and myself. And there's only one other Senate member, that's Senator Chaudhry. So the four major categories in which we recommend allocation are in the areas of land and habitat, water resources, natural resources information, which includes data collection and data updates and inventorying, and environmental education. And so all the recommendations break down into those areas. And if you look in your packet, we have a summary of expected outcomes for the total appropriation of $23.4 million. And I just want to highlight those outcomes that we expect to get from these recommendations if the legislature passes them. First, in the area of land acquisition, that's a priority focus for the LCCMR members. And this would put about $12 million into land acquisition, which would protect forests, wetlands, and other habitat for the benefit of humans, for water quality, and for wildlife. The estimated acreage that would be acquired through a combination of fee title and easements would be 3,400 acres. The second outcome that we expect is land restoration. Approximately over 12,000, almost 13,000 acres of Minnesota land would be restored with $2.5 million of appropriation, and that would mean restoring native plants and removing invasive species, et cetera. The third outcome we can expect is in the area of natural resource planning, inventory, and analysis. Approximately $5.7 million of the appropriation would go into that area, which includes things like the Minnesota Soil Survey, the Minnesota County Biological Survey, Minnesota County Geologic Atlas, which monitors groundwater around Minnesota, and that's been especially important in recent years as we have greater concerns about the use of water, and other areas of data collection and providing comprehensive foundation data so that we can make good natural resource decisions. The fourth category, natural resource research, we do fund direct research by some of our best scientists in the state of Minnesota, and we have about $2 million in research projects recommended. And finally, environmental education and outreach, and we have about $1.2 million recommended for environmental and outreach education efforts. So let me go through the bill quickly, and then we can take any questions about specific recommendations in here. So if you turn to the bill, as I mentioned, the total appropriation is from the trust fund is $22.866 million and $86,000 from the Great Lakes Protection Account. Turning to page two of our kind of marquee projects that we funded over a period of years have been the Metro Conservation Corridors and the Minnesota Habitat Conservation Partnership, known as the Habitat Corridors for Greater Minnesota. Those are on pages 2 and 4, and we continue that appropriation with equal amounts to each of them. Page 4, and those leverage lots of volunteer and financial support from many, many partners around the state. Turning to page 4, the Vermilion River Corridor acquisition will help to acquire land and restore it near the Vermilion River in Dakota County. Let's see. The turning to page 6, preserving the Avon Hills landscape is a area for protection near in Stearns County. The bottom of page 6 onto page 7 is a recommendation to buy easements and acquire land all along the Minnesota River Valley to try to protect that land, and that continues the work we've been doing for many years to try to restore water quality in the Minnesota River and also to create recreational corridors. Scientific and natural area acquisition on page 7, and we wanted to focus that on the southern two-thirds of Minnesota because we wanted to make sure we have balance in this bill. And the next acquisition program on the bottom of page 7 is for forest fragmentation, and that is primarily directed to northern Minnesota to try to deal with the increasing amount of forest fragmentation we're facing in northern Minnesota. Page 8, State Park and Trail Land Acquisition, and this will continue our acquisition of in-holdings for state parks and state trail land that's needed to complete trail segments. Bottom of page 8 is the Metropolitan Regional Park and Program, and that's for land acquisition as well for Metropolitan Regional Park programs, and those are required to have at least a 40% match from non-state money. On page 9, we also have the $1 million recommended for a grant to Wright County to try to start the acquisition and creation of a new regional park on the Bertram chain of lakes in a really beautiful area in Wright County. Bottom of page 9 is the Conservation Partners Environmental Partnerships Matching Grant Program. This is a small appropriation, $150,000, that goes a long ways to help local communities do small projects in their communities, and it leverages literally thousands of volunteers around the state that help to improve water quality and natural resources in their communities. Page 10 includes a trail design program for some southwestern Minnesota counties.
I think I can do that.
Some prairie protection programs, which was another priority of the LCCMR. On pages 10 through 11 includes an appropriation to the Department of Natural Resources to quickly assess what's left of Native Minnesota prairie and try to really accelerate protection, restoration, and enhancement of those areas, as well as the bottom of page 10, a specific appropriation to Martin County to work on prairie restoration. Turning to page 11, there's an appropriation to the Minnesota Recreation and Park Association to work on prairie restoration and protection on parkland across the state. Moving on to the middle of page 11, we have some research programs which continue the next phase of some really important research that's going on by some of our preeminent University of Minnesota scientists to research impacts of climate change and increasing levels of carbon dioxide on prairie and forest production and biofuel production on working prairies to help us move towards bioenergy production on lands that have native prairie plants growing on them. And you'll see at the top of page 12, there is a transfer from the Phillips Biomass Program, which was the LCCMR transferred that money because that appropriation was no longer going to be able to be used for that project. So some of that money was added to this research project. Turning to page 12, we have research programs for the future of energy in Minnesota's water resources. Bottom of page 12 is a further appropriation to Dr. Peter Sorensen, who's done some world-renowned research on carp and how to try to reduce their impact on our waters. Turning to page 13, we have an appropriation for testing pesticides in public drinking water for assessment of riparian buffers in the Whitewater River watershed. Bottom of page 13, we have funded a very innovative zoning program up in Cass County to try to use local zoning and other local government efforts to protect shoreland. On page 14, we're recommending funding for a native shoreland buffer incentives program, the Southeast Minnesota Stream Restoration Projects, and at the bottom of page 14, you'll see the Groundwater Monitoring and County Geologic Atlas Program, which we're trying to fund more of. There's a great need there, and we weren't able to fund it, and it's not something that the DNR is able to do through its existing budget to the extent that it's really needed. We've learned that we don't have a very good handle on the state of our aquifers across southern and western Minnesota and how much water is there and what the impact of current uses is. So that's something we need to really do a better job of into the future, and this will start us in that direction. On page 15, you'll see the $86,000 from the Great Lakes Protection Account. That's just the balance in that fund, and this will go to – it's only allowed to be used for research related to Lake Superior, and so that's what we've appropriated it for to the University of Minnesota. The bottom of page 15, we will continue the work of updating the National Wetlands Inventory. Page 16, the soil survey work, we will try to complete. Is this a? We're getting
it's
well.
Starting
it's
the
a
completion.
Starting the completion of the soil surveys across the state. We have a project to look at precipitation intensities related to runoff and stormwater treatment. The bottom of page 16 and top of page 17, you'll see the Breeding Bird Atlas, yeah, which is a project that is very popular to create this atlas of birds around the state, and it will be made available to the public free of charge. The Restorable Wetlands Inventory is a program that Ducks Unlimited will be doing to try to, again, give us more data about wetlands that are restorable in the southwestern prairie region of Minnesota, where we've lost a lot of wetlands and ducks. And on the bottom of page 17, this is a project to the Raptor Center that the Raptor Center will do to look at creating a database of disease and conditions in wildlife to be able to better handle the impacts of those. Top of page 18, there's a conservation easement program where we're trying to get a better handle. As we put more public money into conservation easements, we want to make sure that the agencies or the public entities, as well as the private entities that are holding these easements, have a program in place to monitor and enforce the requirements on these easements so they actually will be protected in the way that the public dollars demand. And that's similar to the second appropriation to Bowser on page 18. Under the environmental education category, we have an appropriation that will help to produce a new documentary related to Minnesota waters. And this is to the same team that did the History of the Land film that was really well received across Minnesota, which many of you have seen. And then we have a new innovative program for grants to schools, high schools, colleges, and universities to work on measuring their carbon footprint and figuring out plans to try to reduce them at the school level and involve the whole student and faculty and public community in those projects. We have the emerging issues account, which is authorized by law to be set aside for urgent emerging needs, and that is a $155,000 appropriation. That's the extent of the recommendations, and then there's some kind of boilerplate language, and at the end, on page 23 at the bottom, we have one carry forward for a Paul Bunyan State Trail that the LCCMR approved to try to allow that project to be completed. And then on the very last page, page 24, there is some policy language here that makes it clear that under existing law, royalties and proceeds from patents developed from LCCMR projects are property of the state, and this clarifies that this is the LCCMR recommendations are advisory to the legislature, and that also if a product is developed through an LCCMR appropriation, that the proceeds or that amount of money would have to come back to the fund. And that's the bill. Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to take any questions. I have with me Susan Thornton, who's the acting director of the LCCMR.
Senator Vickerman.
Chair, Senator Anderson, maybe I don't know if you said it, I didn't catch it, but there was $98.5 million in requests, and we were only able to fund towards 23. So, which is there, we just didn't have the money.
Mr. Chair, Senator Vickerman, that's a very good point. There's a lot of great proposals, and we spend many, many hours over the summer and fall evaluating them, holding hearings, trying to do some site visits to look at the work that's underway right now, and so we take our job really seriously to use this trust fund money, the interest earnings from the trust fund, to really do the very best work that we can to supplement what our state agencies and private groups are already doing. Because by constitution, we're not supplanting existing work that's going on. We're trying to enhance the work that's going on with our state agencies and to really do our very best to bring great value to our natural resources across the state of Minnesota.
Mr. Chair.
Sir Roblin.
Can I just ask a little bit about the discussion I'm sure you had about the governor's recommendation that money be used from the LCCMR to go to the Lake Vermilion Park? I'm not saying you're doing the wrong thing. I'm just wondering what the thought process was when you rejected the idea.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, Senator Roebling, that's a really good question, and we did have some extensive discussion about that in the LCCMR this summer. The governor's proposal was for, and I can't remember the total dollar amount they were asking for.
$98 million.
$98 million over how many years? Over a...
Initially 65.
Right, but it would be over a 20-year... So they were proposing something that went well beyond the cost of acquiring the land for Lake Vermilion. What we understand now is that the acquisition price for the park is... for the land is somewhere between $10 and $20 million. But what the DNR brought to the LCCMR was a much larger request for almost $100 million, that, and they asked us to pay debt service out of LCCMR funds for a period of 20 years to acquire Lake Vermilion, but to go beyond that in terms of developing that park and to put a large amount of other money aside for park acquisition and improvements. And the LCCMR considered this very seriously, and I think without speaking for all the members, and you can, some of you can speak for yourselves if I say this incorrectly, but my sense is that, or my memory of our discussion is that there's very strong support for Lake Vermilion, for acquiring that land, for creating that park. It's a beautiful piece of land, and we've all gone to visit it and would like to see that happen. But there was not support for setting, for creating a whole new bonding approach for LCCMR dollars, for committing the funds for 20 years into the future to be able to pay debt service and interest. And, you know, there was a lot of other money that the DNR was looking for in that proposal that we wasn't really thoroughly vetted, I didn't think, in terms of whether there was LCCMR support for it. So I've had some discussion with LCCMR members about supporting Lake Vermilion with there may be support for a part of an appropriation in cash when we come next summer and put together our recommendations for next year, if that's still necessary. But we did vote down the proposal that as it was presented by the DNR for $98 million in bonds, essentially, in bonds and debt service.
Mr. Chair, follow-up.
So
it would have been about $5 million a year out of the fund, which this year is $22 million or so. It would have been that, if you do it over 20 years, mm-hmm. almost $100 million.
Between, Mr. Chair, Senator Roebling, somewhere between $5 and $10 million a year that would have been committed for the next 20 years.
Mr. Chair, I'm wondering, since we're getting the interest off the fund, mm-hmm. how has the fund been performing? Because I know that a lot of people's
that?
Funds are down right now. I'm just wondering how this one's performing.
Mm-hmm. I'll ask Ms. Thornton to give you that answer.
Mr. Chair, members, Susan Thornton with the LCCMR staff. The SBI, State Board of Investment, invests the Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund. And the performance last year was very good, 70% invested in stocks, 30% in bonds. And it's an average return of between 7 and 8%. Now, last year, fiscal year 07, I believe it was actually 16% rate of return.
Senator Stumpf.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Stumpf. Or Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a couple questions. Were there any requests from northwestern Minnesota that you considered? I noticed on your sheet or information, let's see, where was it, that there were some references to northwestern Minnesota, this one. But in the language, when I went through and read the bill, there weren't any that I could identify that were actually from northwestern Minnesota. So I was just wondering, were they part of the projects that didn't get funded, or
from the Habitat? Yeah, yeah, Mr. Chair, I'm looking at the Habitat Conservation Partnership, which is a large number of projects around the state, and that does mention northwest Minnesota. I don't remember offhand which projects.
It doesn't seem to mention it in the language.
If you look at accelerator. Do they have that? Do they have that list in front of them?
Yes, they have this list.
If you look at page two of the, if you look at this two-page sheet that breaks down the recommendations, and page two, the Accelerated Prairie Management Survey Acquisition and Evaluation does specifically include Northwest as well as other sections of Minnesota. Oh, good, we have the geographic breakdown of the, this is the habitat corridors. So this is, we do have a map of the habitat corridors projects, which we can show you that they've sort of, they've identified, because they call it a corridors project, they're trying to focus on regions that they try to create connections of land. And rather than just being a scattershot around the state, they're trying to put together areas that where wildlife can travel from place to place and you can try to maintain ecosystems or restore them. And so region one in the Northwest is called the Aspen Parklands, and that's one of their areas of focus in this year's appropriation. So I can get you more information about what that would look like in detail, but it's definitely, you know, if you look at the...
Okay, I'd appreciate that.
...the statewide map, there is a focus in northwestern Minnesota.
And do most of the, Mr. Chairman, do most of these funds go through organizations? And then the organization spend the money, or how does – I noticed a lot of organizations like Ducks Unlimited, and I believe on page page five maybe. Yeah.
Bill?
There's a number of organizations that are listed.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Senator Stumpf, the Habitat Corridors – project is a group of private partners that bring proposals, and then they've worked together for the past five. This is the fifth year, the fifth appropriation in a row. So some of them were under the biennial process, but the last couple have been through the annual process. So they come together and put a proposal together, a joint proposal that they present to us, but they also have a detailed breakdown of each, what each partner will do, what each different organization will be working on. And, it, you know, the money is funneled through the Department of Natural Resources as the fiscal agent or to the through the Board of Bowser. So, yeah, all the different groups that you see here have a different piece of it. And we have in our – I don't have the books with me, but we have you know, very detailed proposals and a description and a work program for each one of these separate appropriations to these separate groups.
Mr. Chairman, on these appropriations, are these matching appropriations that they will, you know, these organizations contribute a certain amount, or do they take a portion of this as administrative fees, or how does it work?
Well, there is... there is a lot of private money leverage, but I'll ask Ms. Thornton to give you a more detailed answer.
Mr. Chair and Senator Stumpf and members, there's a fair amount of leverage in a number of these projects, and then we have guidelines on eligible and ineligible costs, and overhead costs are not eligible, for example. Executive director salaries are not. So we do encourage in-kind contributions. And then we do track, we ask people to report on the dollars, cash or in kind, that they do leverage throughout the time period of the projects. We've stopped writing in language often X number of dollars are required as a match. That can kick in a whole nother level of accounting reporting. So that's just been the approach in the last several years, is to track the match, encourage the in kind. And by narrowing the eligible costs, projects need to come to the table ready, as we call it, ready, willing, and able to accomplish the project.
Just curious, Mr. Chairman, and do these do other projects have a equal competitiveness? And I'm sure the LCMR members, you know, examine it and go out and look at the projects. But, like, if local projects are you know, I think one of them was to clean it, or not clean up, but establish the Red Lake River or something. Do they actually have a way of competing with organizations that, you know, come in as kind of a group?
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Stumpf, they absolutely do. But as we said, there's really stiff competition for the dollars. So we get a lot of proposals, and staff can talk about, you know, how many they got again. But then they're ranked. The staff gives us recommendations about ranking based on different criteria. So we spend time as a commission creating very specific criteria that we'll use to score each project. Every project starts on an equal footing. And so we score them all. The staff gives us recommendations for scoring them. Each of the members score them and rank our proposals. And then we go through a vetting process where we narrow down, you know, we do the first cut to decide which ones we'll bring in for a hearing. And we hear, how many did we hear this year?
63
of the proposals we had hearings on based on our scoring and based on a vote of the commission and a lot of debate and discussion and input from staff. And from reading that thick notebook and, reading the detailed proposals, and then we bring in hearings, 63 of the proposers for hearings. And again, then there's a lot of individual local projects as well as the big partnership proposals that we have hearings on. They all get exactly the same amount of time, you know, 20 minutes or half an hour is allocated for each proposal. And then we have to narrow it down further from there. So we spend a lot of time trying to make sure we give each project equal consideration based on the merits and based on the factors that we agree on as a commission. As you'll recall, a couple of years ago, the LCCMR was changed so that there's 10 legislative members and 7 citizen members appointed by the governor. And so we all kind of have to put our priorities together and to work. We work on a completely bipartisan basis, and we try to ensure geographic balance, and that's an important factor as well.
Mr. Chairman, is there, Senator Anderson, is there a geographic balance? Is there someone from northwestern Minnesota on that? Like, say, from Detroit Lakes North or...
Not a member of the commission.
Okay. The other question I had was on page 15 relating to the updating of the National Wetlands Inventory. Mm-hmm. Could you explain what is the National Wetlands Inventory? I know when the Farm Service Agency inventoried, I think the last time they inventoried was back in the probably the 70s. Well, it took quite a few years, but what exactly is this, and do or will they include restored wetlands, or is this what's the criteria for this inventory?
Mr. Chair, Senator Stumpf and members, thank you, Senator Anderson. As you mentioned, it has been quite a while since the earlier wetlands, National Wetlands Inventory update was done. And this is just as it implies to provide an update to that was done in the early 80s. And this first phase will actually be, and this is a consortium of agencies working on this and with the Fish and Wildlife Service, and this first phase will actually be to acquire the aerial imagery, the new aerial imagery for the entire state to begin this multi-year effort. And I believe this is going to need to take place over several biennia.
And, Mr. Chairman, do you know the criteria for that? Will they be looking at more than just – will they be taking into account restored wetlands?
Mr. Chair, Senator Stumpf, yes.
So
we'll double-check that and get back to you if I'm incorrect. And then we've got another appropriation in here to Ducks Unlimited, which is on page 17, which starting on line 17.14, which is the restorable wetlands inventory. And this is when the original National Wetlands Inventory was done in the early 80s, the original NWI did not map wetland basins that were completely drained. And so this effort, this additional appropriation also will look at those that to help prioritize for restoration those potential wetlands.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, Senator Vickerman.
I was just going to say we worked very hard on this. Spent lots and lots of hours on
doing so these are all the projects that are
Senator Stump, some of these projects, if they don't get enough funding, they can't even use it. So that we have to take that into consideration, just how that works. It wasn't easy putting this together. It'd be easier if we had $98 million instead of 22, or roughly 23. We tried to get those in mass, those that could get the most bang for the buck, is what we tried to do. You get that many people together, and everybody's got his own little project, and I'm included. So we kind of overlooked that. We did what was good for the whole state. I think it was a good package. And I know you're concerned, but I look through here and I see quite a few Northwests and different projects here. Maybe not exactly what you were looking at, but we try to go treat the whole state and do things for the whole state instead of just pick out one certain spot.
Yeah, so, Mr. Chair, there's a lot of good projects that don't get funded every year, and a lot of them hopefully will come back and maybe have another shot at it the next time. So we do our best. That's one of the good things about having a yearly process.
Okay, further questions for Senator Anderson? Further discussion? If not, Senator Anderson moves that Senate File 2492 be recommended to pass.
As amended.
As amended, I'm sorry. Further discussion on that motion. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. I think I saw Sarah Michelle.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Senate File 3069. There is a division report which is being distributed.
I'll move adoption of the division report.
Well, that's being distributed. I understand, Chair Michelle, there's a delete everything amendment.
The A2, Mr. Chair.
And we also have the A2 amendment distributed.
Mr. Chairman, if we don't need the division report, I'll withdraw my motion. Chairman, I'll move the delete everything amendment for Senator Michelle.
Okay. Senator Berlin moves the A2 amendment. I believe we have that distributed. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. Senator Michelle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. As the snow melts outside, we have a big event coming to Minnesota. In June, the best female golfers in the world will be coming to Interlochen Country Club for the U.S. Women's Open. The third week in June of this year, so it's like 3 months away. So the bill before you would allow for temporary permits on a, call it a small fleet of courtesy cars. This is what transports the players and some staff to the tournament just during the time of the tournament's being played. So just during that small amount of time in June of this year. A little history on this. When we have hosted other large golf tournaments in Minnesota, we had the PGA Championship back in the early 90s. We did a similar, the state passed similar authorization to allow for these temporary license permits on these courtesy cars. I would also predict you'll need to do it again in the next year because we have another PGA Championship coming to Hazeltine in a couple years. So we're going to see this, I think, again, Mr. Chair, the A2 that you just adopted lines up the language with what the House language that's been used. I know of no opposition, Mr. Chair. I have Alyssa Schlander from the Minnesota Auto Dealers Association who's been helping with this legislation, and appreciate your support.
So, Sarah Michelle, what do the permits do? What's the purpose of the permits?
The permit, Ms. Schlander, do you want to give the two sentence?
Sorry,
Schlander.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Alyssa Schlander with the Minnesota Auto Dealers Association. Mr. Chair, the permit just acts like a temporary license plate so that the professional golfers can legally drive the vehicles on the road.
Mr. Chairman.
Sarah Berglund.
Mr. Chairman, I noticed that there's a fee of $10 for the permit, but there's no language in the bill that actually appropriates the money collected to the Department of Public Safety.
Great.
Just a technical, I think we need to authorize them to spend the money.
That's a good point. We'll draft some language between Mr. Mossman and Mr. Watson. Sir Michelle, I'm still just a little bit confused. So this allows cars to go on which roads?
Mr. Chair and members, on the public streets. It would just act like a license plate so that they're not driving vehicles that are not plated. Because they'll be driving these vehicles for about 14 or 15 days.
So these are not cars otherwise licensed in Minnesota?
They're brand new vehicles.
So do dealers donate vehicles for this purpose?
Mr. Chair, the vehicle manufacturer donates the vehicles for the women to drive, but they remain brand new vehicles. They're not titled and plated like as though they were buying the vehicles.
So the sponsor, if Ford or Chrysler or somebody is sponsoring the Women's Open, they'll donate a fleet of vehicles which need to be licensed in some fashion.
That's correct.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman?
Sarah Stumpf.
Just a question about the fiscal note, and it talks about $500 for the design and $6 for manufacturing or the cost of the plate. For some odd reason, I was under the assumption that the cost of the plate was more. Is there a way or somebody from...
Aren't these like cardboard?
Whoever makes the plates. I know the plates, I think, are made in
still
by the state. But do we know, is that does the fiscal note cover the cost?
Ms. Schlander?
Mr. Chair, Senator, it'll be something less than a license plate. It's not meant to be anything used longer than 2 weeks. So I think that's why the fiscal note is so small.
Okay.
Do we have some language to suggest?
Mr. Chair and members, there's already an appropriation in law for the money that's collected for these license plate fees to be appropriated. We are checking on whether or not, because this is a permit rather than a plate, whether or not it needs to be adjusted, but otherwise there would already be standing appropriation authority in law, which is why I think you don't see it in the bill.
Well, do we have further questions for Sarah Michelle or Ms. Schlander?
Mr. Chairman, Sir
Fredrickson.
Senator Michelle. Are there two of these temporary plates for each vehicle or just one? Two. Okay.
Sir Michelle, that was a two. Is that correct?
Yes, sir, Mr. Chair. Two, Senator Fredrickson.
Sir Vickerman.
Mr. Chair, just look at the amount of money that will come in to the state.
Look at, I'm serious.
Blows us away.
Oh, from the whole event.
I couldn't watch them.
The whole event, you meant. Yeah, not the $2,500 on the plates.
Mr. Chair, and Senator Vickerman, I know that the goal is that this will be the highest attended U.S. Women's Open event ever. And so that would be tens of thousands of people into Minnesota for this. Not to mention some good golfers, too.
Sir Michelle, you said the highest attended golf event?
Women's golf event.
Women, okay. I assume the highest was, what, the U.S. Open in 91?
Mm-hmm.
Sarah Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, we all seem so confused by this. We must not have done this before. You think we would have done this before?
Did.
Sir Michelle indicated that it would have been done probably then, what, 91?
91 for the U.S. Open at Hazeltine. You would have. You did.
We did.
And when was the PGA? Was that 99 or something, or 2000?
Right, we had the PGA in...
application fee.
Tony, when was the PGA?
Some other year.
And we have another PGA coming up, Senator Pappas, in next year, again at Hazeltine. So this is kind of built into the regime of running one of these large tournaments is this fleet of courtesy cars, allowing them on the streets for a couple weeks. So but we have done it, but we've done it just for that event.
Mm. Well, we're waiting to try to find out what we need to do or not do. Is it only true of golf tournaments, or what about the Super Bowl, Republican Convention? Of course, the convention's not the convention's not sponsored by a auto dealer, auto manufacturer, but
it might be. I can't speak.
Maybe
that,
your convention.
Sure.
But is it done for the Super Bowl or?
Well, not that I'm aware of, Mr. Chair. And the difference would be the Super Bowl is one day. This is a week of activity. And so the players are either at hotels or literally some are staying at private residences throughout the Twin Cities. And so we need to get them back and forth to the course on a daily basis.
Mr. Chair, there's a provision under the dealer plate law, you know, the little temporary plate that you use when you test drive a vehicle. Dealers can use the dealer plate for courtesy purposes, but it's only up to 4 days. So that's why for a tournament of this length, we need a special piece of legislation.
Do we have an answer yet as to what we... Mr. Watson?
Mr. Chairman, the normal statute under which these special plates or... permits are done is referred to in line 8 of the amendment, 168.1293. This provides
for a permit fee, and the permit fee is deposited in the state treasury and credited to the vehicle services operating account in the special revenue fund.
And then the language says an amount sufficient to pay the department's cost in implementing the administering the section, including payment of refunds, is appropriated to the commissioner. So there is
an open appropriation in the statute for this kind of thing.
Okay. All right. Further.
Mr. Chairman, I'll move the bill.
Okay. Senator Tomasoni moves that Senate file 3069 as amended be recommended to pass. Further discussion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No. Motion carries. Thank you, Senator Michelle.
Thank you.
Senator Scoy. Senate file 3728. Zero division.
Okay, I have an A4 amendment.
And before Senator Scoy begins, let me just point out we have this bill and another bill on the agenda. But we do have an appropriation provided in the supplemental finance bill for this purpose. Senator Scoy, however, would like to have this bill move independently, not being sure what's going to happen. It's going to discuss with us the importance of the issue and the need to ensure passage this year in one form or another.
So. I'll move adoption of the A4 amendment.
Mr. Chair, do you want me to walk through the amendment before it's adopted?
Let's wait till it's distributed. And as we're finishing distributing it, let me just point out that the language in the A4 amendment is more complete in terms of the issue than what we have in the finance bill, and that's something else of that's needed relative to this issue. Senator Berglund moves adoption of the A4 delete everything amendment.
Mr. Chairman.
There's an oral amendment to the amendment before it's adopted, please.
Okay, Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, I'm just wondering about these delete all amendments that maybe we shouldn't adopt them right away without them being explained, because this is not the first committee that this bill is before, and how do we know that the author isn't totally changing the work that was done by the policy committee? So I think we need some explanation before we adopt delete all amendments.
That's fine. Senator Scoia, do you want to go through the amendment and
yes,
maybe
Mr. Chair,
contrast
Senator,
it to what was done earlier?
Senator Pappas, I really do agree with you, because I'm uncomfortable with the delete everything amendment at this point. However, this is the delete everything amendment is what I've been talking about in all the committees. The bill as introduced was introduced a while ago. We have had a number of meetings. It was in Winoska last Monday. The Monday previous, I have met with USDA. I've had meetings with other stakeholders' organizations. And as we've gone along, we've clarified and finalized the language. But I'm very comfortable going through the amendment first. Let me just start by giving you a little background on what's happening in Minnesota with regard to bovine tuberculosis. We do have a bovine tuberculosis outbreak in northwestern Minnesota. there have been 13 herds that have had positive tests and have been depopulated by USDA. I think we have completed the final herd depopulation just last week. There is a small percentage of bovine tuberculosis in the deer herd. Bovine tuberculosis spreads by contact between infected animals and non-infected animals when they either breathe or have saliva that interchanges between the two animals. This is a hard disease to control. There is no exact plan as to how to achieve, to reestablish bovine TB free status, but we do have models as to what not to do. We can look at other states such as Michigan that has bovine TB in their cattle and in their deer. They have spent in the excess of $120 to $160 million over the last 8 to 10 years, and they're actually worse off than they were when they started because they didn't deal with this aggressively enough. Minnesota has a relatively small infestation, as I said. We are dealing with this aggressively. I've been working with the DNR to reduce the number of the deer in the area. This is an effort, Senate File 3728 is an effort to reduce the number of cattle in the area. Mostly what this bill does is it proposes a herd buyout of cattle that are in a small 56 herd zone where we have had positive bovine TB tests. And what we're proposing to do is give these producers a $500 one-time payment, a $75 ongoing payment until Minnesota is bovine TB free. It is voluntary. If the producer does not choose to take the buyout, the Board of Animal Health will do a risk assessment of their farm, and they will determine appropriate measures to ensure that there's no interaction between deer and cattle. That is then will lead more than likely to significant fencing requirements on those farms. We will be fencing the feeding areas that those farm has, and all farms in the management zone will be required to fence all of their feedstocks. It's controversial in both the deer hunters arena, but the Deer Hunters Association is supportive of my plan. It's also somewhat controversial with cattle producers in the area, but after a number of meetings with these individuals, they have come to recognize that the best course of action is to act aggressively and act quickly. There is that is mostly what is in the section one and of the bill. Section two of the bill, or the amendment, gives the Board of Animal Health the authority to split the state into two categories. It's important that we do that so that we don't have to do extensive testing in the southern and western part of the states where there has been no bovine TB found. We have done 1,500 tests of 1,500 herds across the state, and we have no positive tests anywhere other than in this very small area. And that's Section 2. Section 3. Section 3 is a provision that has been, part of which has been passed out of the Environment Policy Committee, and at the time we passed the expansion of the feeding zone, feeding ban zone radius, we also had discussion at that time about the ability to have a little larger impact or penalty for people who violate the feeding ban. And that is the provision in here where we would give the commissioner the authority to revocate a person's hunting license for up to 2 years if they violate the feeding ban. The feeding ban is important because that's the area where the deer would potentially transmit bovine TB between the deer, the wild deer herd. Section 4, as we've gone through this, figuring out how much money we're going to need to get Minnesota back into bovine TB status, it's apparent that we do not have enough money in the state to do the work that's required. The Cattlemen's Association is going to be assessed a dollar a head sold in Minnesota. That money will go to the Board of Animal Health for bovine tuberculosis control activities. It will raise about $1.5 million. Section 5 is the appropriation section. The $472,000 in 08, the $2,252,000 in 09 are the governor's recommendations for monitoring, testing, and eradicating and other things dealing with bovine tuberculosis. And the $3.5 million in Clause B is the money that we are asking to do the herd buyout and other activities related with bovine tuberculosis elimination. I think that pretty much covers the background and the amendment. Mr. Knopf, did I forget anything?
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Skoy, you said you had oral change to the amendment. I'd like to incorporate that for you if you can tell us what it is.
On page 1, line 30, I would like to strike 50 and insert 75. And the reason for that is we think that we have discussions as of this Monday up in Winnoska. We would have better participation in the buyout and less needs for fencing monies if we had the ongoing payment just slightly higher. That raises the cost about $75,000 a year in ongoing money. But we think that that can come out of that money that the department has.
So I would incorporate that into the amendment, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, Senator Berlin has incorporated that. Senator Skoy, let me ask, with the change from 50 to 75, does the appropriation still match then?
Mr. Chair, I've been working with the Board of Animal Health as to whether we think this will fit within the appropriation. It makes it a little tighter, but we think that it's doable.
Okay. Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair and Senator Skoy, on that same section that you're amending, the owner of the herd would receive the annual payments until the area is declared TB-free. Is that a county area? Is that a – what area are we – how big an area and how long does one think that might be?
Mr. Chair and Senator Higgins, the management zone is a bovine tuberculosis zone that's defined earlier in the bill. Basically, it's about a 34-mile diameter, kind of oblong circle up in the Winnoska, Skyme, Grigley area of northwestern Minnesota. We think with the aggressive action that Minnesota is taking, it's conceivable that we could become bovine TB free in that area in 4 years, but it might take 5 or so years.
So, Mr. Chair and Senator Skoy, so this is just for that one area up there in Grigla and all those other towns I've never heard of?
Yes, Mr. Chair and Senator Higgins. Senator Higgins, what happens is in this bill we're giving the Board of Animal Health the authority to do what is called a split state status. The rest of the state will receive a higher level accreditation, and they will not be required to do all the extensive testing that is so costly. We think that the split state status is going to be about 300 herds up in that area, which is a slightly larger zone. But for the buyout, we're just targeting the area where we have had positive bovine TB tests already. and trying to focus our dollars in on us on this small area so that we can really get a handle on this disease.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Stumpf.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Skoy, thank you for carrying this legislation. I know you've spent many, many hours and lots of meetings trying to put this all together, and also the Board of Animal Health has done an excellent job. But it is a tough issue and one that seems to be persistent. The question I have is, when we talk about farm servidate, do we also include elk in that definition?
Mr. Chair and Senator Stump, Mr. Knopf tells me yes.
Okay. The next question is, you have a study in here, and it relates to, I'm trying to find it again. It's the it's the study anyway that
Mr.
the
Chair, page 4, line 27.
Okay. And what I'm wondering about, here it is. It's $150,000 to study the life cycle of bovine tuberculosis in pasture. What I'm wondering about is that I wonder if it wouldn't be wiser to have that study done in the same area where we have the tuberculosis, the TB. Because once you initiate that study over in Grand Rapids, the potential, if it isn't controlled, could be that you may have tuberculosis over there and pop up in some deer or some cattle via deer. And consequently, we'd end up with a situation like that, like we have in northwestern Minnesota over in central Minnesota, north central.
Mr. Chair and Senator Stump, I'm glad you brought this to the committee's attention and my attention, because I do have another oral amendment that I had oversight on here. The reason that we do that in Grand Rapids is that's where the University of Minnesota cattle herd is. Some of the majority of this work is going to be done up in the area or perhaps down in St. Paul, but this is where the personnel come from. And so I think it's appropriate for the money to flow through that station. And what the current language or the original bill language was to study the life cycle of bovine tuberculosis in pasture. I need to offer an oral amendment that would delete a study of the life cycle on page 4, line 28, and on page 4, line 34, and insert BMPs to control. And I will talk about that if it's okay, Mr. Chair. In the meeting that
incorporate that into the amendment also.
Okay.
And then also, Madam Chair, on line 4.28 and 4.29, I need to delete in pasture. And on 4.35, delete in pasture.
Senator Scully, hold on one second. Do you have all this?
Mr. Chairman, if you wanted,
can you repeat that, please?
Let me just go over it. It would be on line 4.28 and on line 4.34, delete a study of the life cycle of and insert best management practices to control in both instances. And then on the end of 4.28, delete in. On 4.29, delete pasture. And then on 4.35, delete in pasture.
I'll incorporate that into the motion I made for the amendment.
Okay. Senator Berglund incorporates that into her previous motion.
And Mr. Chair and members, the reason that we need to do these best management practices is part of USDA's requirements of the state of Minnesota as we move forward with our bovine tuberculosis eradication, is that in these areas where we are removing the cattle herds, we want to make sure that we have best management practices in place when the cattle come back onto the land to make sure that we don't reinfest the herds with bovine tuberculosis. And that's the reason that we need to have this language in there, is it's part of the development of those management practices that USDA is going to require of us.
Mr. Chairman, on this particular, Mr. Chairman and Senator Scalia, I'm sorry, but I don't think I heard a good explanation as to how that's going to be controlled.
Statewide.
That study is going to be controlled. I can understand the university down here in St. Paul because they do have statewide. A control lab for containing any virus or disease, but I don't think the Grand Rapids University has that type of facility, and so I'm just wondering. I just want to be sure that this issue has been aired and thought about.
Mr. Chair and Senator Stump, they are not going to take bovine tuberculosis to the Grand Rapids Experiment Station to do work on it there. If there is life cycle work that needs to be done, it'll very likely be done in the lab in St. Paul. The University of Minnesota personnel that work with cattle are stationed in Grand Rapids at the cattle herd. So I would envision that they would be doing some travel up into the bovine TB control area up in Winoska, Skyim, Grigla area, and then they will be also doing some work with the lab in St. Paul. That's what I'm envisioning will happen. I don't expect that they would consider taking the virus into the Grand Rapids station.
Okay. It just seemed like when I read it, it sounded as if you're going to study the life cycle in pasture was at Grand Rapids. All right. Thank you.
Sir Roblin.
Thank you. Senator Scott, I'm just wondering how many cattle, there's four or five farms right now, and I'm wondering how many cattle are currently on those farms, and have they any idea, and Senator Higgins somewhat asked this, but how long does that virus live? Does it live in the soil, or where does it contain itself after the cattle are removed?
Curious.
Mr. Chair and Senator Roebling, currently we've had 13 herds depopulated. We have no herds left in the state that are positive tested for bovine TB. There are 56 herds in this management zone that is established that could potentially be depopulated. So that's kind of the numbers the Board of Animal Health is not estimating. They know what's up there. There's about 3,500 animals, I believe. And so that's what the potential number is to be depopulated through the passage of this bill. With regard to the life cycle of virus, there has been a fair amount of research done on this. We're going to certainly do a search of all the publications. This virus will survive for a fair amount of time in the right conditions, which are moist and cool. If there's bright sunshine and warm weather, it does kill fairly easily. And so that's part of the development of the best management practices. So if we depopulate these animals, we will go in and require that the farms will be cleaned up. They'll spread out the manure, let the sun shine on it, disinfect barns, that sort of thing, in order to win over time. Those animals do go back onto those farms that we do not reinfest them. And that is going to be required by USDA. These management practices will be required.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Stump.
I'm sorry, I have a couple more questions. On the top of page 3, where you have 300 herds, can you give a description? When we're talking about, first of all, dividing the state into a zone or more than one zone, is that federally required? I want that to be on the record.
Mr. Chair and Senator Stump, it is not federally required that we split the state. And the size of the split-off area is not necessarily determined by the USDA. The Board of Animal Health will make a proposal, then the USDA will come into the state, do a risk assessment, and make a determination if the size of the area is adequate in order to control bovine tuberculosis and not have positive tests in the split-off area. In the original bill, or the bill as amended that we have been discussing, we were asking the Board of Animal Health to not consider any herd split size larger than 200 herds. In USDA, their current rules are 201 herds, but they have proposed rules that would make this split state size 1,000 herds. So we've been going through this discussion with USDA as to what is an acceptable size area to split off so that we can manage the zone, because we need to have law enforcement or other agencies inspecting all the cattle that are coming in and out of this area. We have to do annual herd tests on all of these animals inside this area. So it's going to take a fair amount of resources inside this area. So the smaller the zone, the more efficient we can be at targeting the resources. But we also want to make sure it's large enough so that we don't see positive tests coming up outside of the zone. And 300 herds appears to be the number that Board of Animal Health thinks can accomplish the goal that we will have resources to deal with and USDA will accept. We will not have an answer to that question for some time. I believe the process is that we will officially lose our level in accreditation perhaps today, or certainly by the end of the week. The Board of Animal Health is in process of having discussions with USDA about the size, but in the intervening time until we do the split state status, we have to test every animal in the state that is moved out of state. Some states have already placed restrictions on travel into their states, North Dakota and I believe Wisconsin. And so we're going to go through this summer with this intermediate step, and sometime hopefully by September we will have gone through the risk assessment, the USDA will analyze our application, and we will then know what split state size will be acceptable. But currently of discussions, I think 300 herds is the size that everybody can kind of agree to.
And Mr. Chairman and Senator Scoy, with a 300 herd number, what does that zone look like?
You know, Mr. Chair and Senator Stumpf, if I would have come from my office, I was planning on bringing my folder along in which I did have maps, but I had another bill up in committee, so I didn't get to walk through my office. But just roughly, it's from the Canadian border down to about the north boundary line of the Red Lake Reservation where it crosses Highway 1. They're south of Four Towns, you know where that is. And then an area, I'm guessing, about 50 miles wide.
So it would stay above Highway 1.
It would stay above Highway 1. It's about 50 miles wide to the Canadian border. And that's, I can get you a map, Senator Stumpf, of the proposed area.
Okay, I'd appreciate
and
that.
And I planned on having that, but I didn't walk through my office.
Thank you.
Okay. We have the A4 amendment in front of us. Senator Berglund has moved the A4 amendment. Is there further discussion on the amendment? And again, we've had the changes incorporated by Senator Berglund. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. Senator Scoy.
Well, Mr. Chair, we've gone through the bill as amended. I think I've talked about everything that I have that's included in this. I think I've laid out the from my perspective, the need, but I'd be happy to answer any other questions.
Okay. Mr. Chairman,
and Senator Berglund,
it appears that you have an A6 yes. amendment also, Senator Scoy, that deals with the fact that we have this appropriation in the finance bill as well.
And I was about to mention that if we could have distributed the A6 amendment.
We have it.
Okay.
Right. So I would move the A6 amendment.
And members, what this amendment does is to make sure there's no double counting of this appropriation, depending on what happens as the session proceeds. Further discussion on the A6 amendment. Senator Stumpf.
Mr. Chairman, one more question. On page 1, line 23, Senator Scoy, can you just elaborate on what the penalties are?
Mr. Chair and Senator Stump, I believe that the penalties are that they're going to repay any payments that they – let me make sure that I'm – Mr. Chair, Dr. Hartman is here, and perhaps he could help you because the Board of Animal Health does have some broader penalty authority that I'm not familiar with. Dr. Hartman?
Doctor, if you could identify yourself for the record, please.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Bill Hartman, Executive Director of the Board of Animal Health and State Veterinarian. The board does have broad authorities, and we have administrative penalties up to $10,000, and then we have authorities for gross misdemeanors if we need them. Does that answer the question?
Okay. Further questions? Okay. Thank you, Dr. Harvin. Okay. We have Senator Berglund has moved adoption of the A6 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed. Motion carries. Further discussion, Senator Berglund has moved that Senate file 3728 as amended be recommended to pass. Is there further discussion on that motion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion carries. Thank you, Senator Scoy.
Thank you very much, members and Mr. Chair.
We have two bills left. Senator Thomasoni, I hate to do this to you, but Senator Sharon's here. She's not a member of the committee.
We have an amendment that we're
not quite.
For.
You're not quite ready. Okay, Senator Thomasoni, go ahead. Okay, we have Senate File 3300.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Senator, members of the committee. Mr. Chairman, maybe what I should do first, in Senator Pappas' committee, we made a little change because there was no actual reference to the taconite industry in the bill, and Mr. Watson has given me an A2 amendment that maybe cleans it up just a little bit better. So if I could just put the A2 amendment on the bill then before we get started, Mr. Chairman.
If we could have that distributed. I don't see Senator Pappas. Senator Roebling moves adoption of the division report that I believe we have. This is the Higher Education Division report. Is that, well, it's under division report from Senator Thomasoni's division, but we're adopting the amendment, Senator Thomasoni, that you're looking for apparently is from higher ed. So we need to adopt the higher ed division report and not your division report. So I don't see Senator Pappas. Senator Roebling's a member of the division. Senator Roebling moves adoption of the division, what's titled Division 1 Division Report. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed. Motion carries. And then did you have a further amendment, or was it simply the division,
Mr. Chairman,
report?
We put an amendment on in Senator Pappas' committee.
Yeah, well, that would be incorporated in the division report.
Correct. And so, Mr. Watson seems to think this A2 amendment actually cleans up that amendment a little bit, make it a little bit more readable, right. I guess, or work a little more workable.
Okay,
and
well,
so I maybe don't need to do it, but I think it's probably a good suggestion to put the A2 amendment on because I think it's clearer than what was done in Senator Pappas' committee.
All right, well, have we had distribution of the A2 amendment? Mm-hmm. Okay, we've got that in front of us.
Mr. Chairman, all this does is just indicate that the study is related to the taconite industry and make sure that, because that was never ever actually delineated in the bill.
All right, Senator Thomasoni moves adoption of the A2 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
I'm sorry, before we vote, Senator Roebling.
I'm just looking at the reference to line 10. I think it's And we want to take out that whole line?
Of the division report.
That's of the division report.
I'm sorry. Looking at the wrong amendment.
Okay, we've got the A2 amendment in front of us. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed. Motion carries. Senator Tomasoni.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senate File 3300, as amended, is the study of mesothelioma that we've been working on with in conjunction with the University of Minnesota. As you all know, we've had a rash of deaths over the last few years from this insidious disease. And, 58 people have died over the last few years, and we're trying to get a handle on exactly where it's coming from and what's causing it. And it's mostly related to the mining industry, and we've had a couple of studies over the years that haven't given conclusive results. And so once and for all, we want to get this done, and we want to get it done right. And so what Senate File 3300 does, Mr. Chairman, is it appropriates $4.9 million from the Workers' Compensation Special Fund to the University of Minnesota. And the University of Minnesota has been working already on organizing groups to get together to make sure that this particular study gets done and gets done right. We've had the Minnesota Taconite Workers Lung Health Partnership put together already. It includes state and federal agencies, mining companies, unions, healthcare organizations, and elected officials to try and make sure that this thing gets off the ground and gets going and gets done. The U is looking at probably about a five-year period to actually do this. They will be reporting back to us yearly to let us know what kind of progress they're making and what kind of discoveries they're coming up with. And quite frankly, we're very excited to get this done because we've been working on this for a number of years. And this disease is one of those diseases that actually manifests itself over 15 to 30 years after people have been exposed to it. And so to try and find out exactly what's causing it and where it's coming from and basically how to protect the new people that are coming into the industry and working in the industry is the scope and focus of this. And, Mr. Chairman, this bill will get that done.
Senator Berlin.
Chairman and Senator Tomasoni, the only comment I have about this is that I'm so glad we're finally getting on track with this. And I think for members that this is an example of how when we discover that we have a problem, if we all work together, we can get toward finding a solution for it. When we try not to admit we have problems is when we do the citizens of the state a disservice.
Thank you.
Senator Roblin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I did have the opportunity, we had an extensive discussion on this in higher ed, and I have no argument with the study. I think the study's important and necessary, and as Senator Berglund said, it's time to get to the bottom of it. But I have a problem with the source of funding. And as it's set up right now, it's all coming out of the Workers' Comp Special Fund. And that's a fund we've tapped into in the past, I realize. But I object to it to becoming kind of a extra reserve fund for the state to cover things that probably should be covered in the general funds. It's a tax that is assessed against businesses that should be reduced if the needs for what it's being assessed for are also reduced, or if there's less need for the fund, the businesses and across the state should benefit from that decrease and shouldn't have to pick up the costs of special projects that are very, very dedicated only to one specific industry. And so I do have the A3 amendment to have a little more discussion about this. Because, Mr. Chair, I don't think anyone's going to argue about the need for the fund, but I think the argument does come in where the money comes from. And I know the general fund doesn't have any money right now, or I certainly would go for that. That would be my first target, because it's something that we have often funded studies from. But because this is a problem that is so directly affiliated with the mining industry, and the money that the IRRRB gets comes from the mining industry, I think that would be an appropriate place to look to get half of the money needed for this study. And so my amendment does that. It cuts the $4.9 million in half. Against my better wishes, I'm leaving half of it funded by the Workers' Comp Special Fund, but then I'm looking to the IRRRB to fund the other half because it is a problem that is directly affiliated with the mines, and I think that the mines, the mining companies themselves, should be responsible for helping to fund this, and that the assessments that the IRRRB gets are from the mines. And I don't know if, you know, maybe there's not enough funds in there right now, but maybe more could be assessed for this special purpose. I don't know if that would mean going into some other section of law and changing that or not. But I just want to put this out here for discussion because I don't want to take it all from the Workers' Comp Special Fund.
Well, Senator Roebling, just I'll let Senator Thomas only comment, but just a couple of questions. Isn't the appropriation from the Workers' Comp Fund, I mean, it's one question, from the Workers' Comp Fund more appropriate since this is a work-related health situation as opposed to coming from a fund that's basically an economic development fund? As I understand, the IRRRB
and Mr. Chairman,
Senator Thomasoni,
I can comment on that for Senator.
Can I respond to that one, though?
Okay, go ahead.
The mines are making money at perhaps the risk of the employees that are working there, that are at risk for getting this, and so it's for them it is an economic issue for the mines. They need workers. And we need to find out if the workers who are working there are being put at risk and how we can reduce that risk. The mines should be very interested in that as well. And because, I mean, their own economic well-being kind of depends upon people being willing to work there. And you know, I would think that they would want to resolve this issue as more than anybody.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Thomasoni.
Right off the bat, I just would like to say that I would oppose this amendment. You are absolutely correct in saying that this is coming from an economic development fund, but in addition, it's taxpayers' property tax money that's in lieu of the mining companies paying property taxes, and so this is actually a property tax appropriation. In addition, the money that we're looking at here is not available at the agency. This particular fund has been obligated, and so there are projects that this money would already be paying for, and so the agency wouldn't be able to absorb this amount. In addition, the Workers' Compensation Safety Fund has a consultation unit, and in the description of what the unit does, coming right from the department, it says that this activity assists employers and employees to implement effective safety and health programs to prevent injuries and illnesses that may result from exposure to hazardous workplace conditions and work practices. In addition, the unit provides services in assisting employers and employees to recognize hazards in the workplace, suggesting approaches or options for solving a safety or health problem, providing a timely written report of findings to employers, including posting of hazards. And so this is exactly what this fund is for. And quite frankly, the difference between what the fund does now and what the University of Minnesota does is that there's actually employees at the department that do it in a lot of instances. In this case, we'd be contracting the workout so that we can get a neutral opinion and make sure that everything is coming without any kind of bias whatsoever, and that we're going to actually find out what the solution is. And so I think, Mr. Chairman, that the fund is the appropriate place. And in addition, there's a $26 million balance in the fund right now. And the projection is that the department is making has that going all the way out to 2011 and still being a $15 million amount in the fund, and the assessments are continuing to go down. So I think this is the appropriate place to get the money, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. We have the A3 amendment in front of us. Is there further discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
No. No.
Motion fails. Senator Anderson.
Mr. Chair, I thought this might be a good time to point out the discussion that's going on right now to open new mines in northern Minnesota, the copper sulfide mines. And Senator Dibble and I have been working with Senator Tomasoni, Bach, and Saxhog on this issue because what we want to do as we open the, you know, get into this new form of mining in Minnesota is to make sure that these financial issues and worker protection issues are dealt with up front. And so we don't have legislation now. I think there'll probably be legislation next session that I hope we can be negotiated with all the parties involved, including the mine owners. But what we're looking at is making sure that as these new kinds of mines open, that there is a fund set aside to protect the taxpayers and to protect the workers on into the future, even if the mines close someday. And so that there's money set aside that cannot be raided that will be sure that if there's any health impacts or any environmental impacts, that those are not lingering for taxpayers to pick up later. And so I think I just wanted to point out that we are sort of learning that this is, you know, this is an unfortunate health legacy for Iron Range workers, and we want to make sure that doesn't happen again. Yeah.
Thanks. And I'm sure we could have a much lengthier, and deserves a much lengthier conversation and discussion. We do have one more bill on the agenda. So, Senator Tomasoni?
Do you want me to comment?
Certainly.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Anderson and I have talked about this, and the study itself will probably help us understand what might be coming from that new industry that's coming in. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a good thing. And there's absolutely no doubt about the fact that that legacy costs should be dealt with in the mining industry. And in fact, we're we're doing a lot of that right now. And I think there's a lot of provisions in the law that require it already. But having that discussion and deciding whether or not we're insured enough for the future consequences is something we should definitely talk about.
Okay. Further discussion on the bill. If not, Senator Tomasoni moves that Senate File 3300 as amended be recommended to pass. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you, Senator Tomasoni.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And the last bill we have on the agenda is Senate File 3573, Senator Sharon. Members, as with Senator Skoy's bill, we have heard this issue before. Some of the language is contained within the supplemental finance bill and Senator Pappas's article of the bill. Senator Sharon, as has Senator Skoy, is requesting that the bill move forward on its own as well. Senator Sharon.
Thank you, Chairman Cohen. I have a copy of, over on the desk over there is a copy of the report from Bridging the Health Continuum Working Group. I'm hoping that that would be distributed.
Senator Sharon?
The Senate File 3573 is a bill that authorizes the Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Health to award a grant to the extent that there's available appropriations to the University of Minnesota to develop a model to assess the impact of proposed health care reforms on all sectors of the health care system. It also authorizes the Minnesota Department of Health to award a grant to the extent of available appropriations to the university to study the cost and benefits of various health care reform proposals. To what extent, Chairman Coleman, would you like me to sort of orient everybody to the essence of
well,
the bill?
Well, certainly feel free to spend a couple of minutes. Unfortunately, we're running late. And
Mr. Chairman,
we have heard the issue before, Senator Berglund.
This came out of a working group of the Healthcare Access Commission, and I think I could just give an example that would help to clarify what this bill is trying to get at. An example would be that if we could prevent diabetes from advancing. If we could prevent people with diabetes from developing blindness, amputation, and kidney failure, how much could that then impact or reduce the need for long-term care facilities or long-term care appropriations in the state? That's an example, and that's something that our finance department in the Department of Human Services does not, they just don't have the capacity to be able to forecast that kind of thing. This model could help us be able to do that and would be a tremendous resource then in terms of helping us figure out where to target our resources to get the most bang for our buck.
Senator Sharon.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Berglund. If you would, if in the report that was just handed out to you, if you would turn to page 14, you will see a graph. And in that graph, on page 14, what it is depicting there, this is for the global modeling model that we're developing. You will see us depicting the various sectors or silos that we're attempting to do an analysis of. There's the public health component, there's the health insurance component, and the long-term care component, or silo. And then surrounding that, of course, is all the other social services, housing, nonprofit agencies, and informal caregivers that are a part of the healthcare delivery system and providing services. What is happening in the healthcare reform bill is that there's a great deal of analysis of how we can, by investment in prevention, capture the cost savings in the health insurance through the reinvestment and the focus of our resources on prevention so that we can reduce the cost of chronic care, for example. But what we are not really analyzing, but that this bill adds to us, is the capacity to take a look at that third sector along the line there, which is the long-term care and home community-based services sector. We are not in the health care reform bill looking at the impact of early intervention, and therefore we're not able to analyze adequately what the health care savings might be and what we could capture and then further invest in prevention programs or in making it health care accessible. So this model adds that element, and also is the principal component of the model is taking a look at how health care policies that we may initiate might create cost shifting anywhere along the course of this continuum, including perhaps what we might be doing that appears to be cost savings but is, in effect, cost shifting to long-term care or cost shifting to the county social services programs. So, in this bill, what we are trying to design is a global modeling tool that will be able to help us analyze that and pick up on cost savings and opportunities that we might have in these various sectors for cost savings. The second section of this bill focuses on Subdivision 2 on how the University of Minnesota needs to make that model available to the state agencies in the legislature. And there's also a segment there that I think we've talked about a great deal in the course of the meetings that we may need a motion this morning to eliminate from this legislation, which calls for the use of some of this information in the development of fiscal notes. And then in Section 2 is a completely different component, and that is once the model is developed, it will be able to accomplish some of the objectives that I've just listed. In the second economic analysis of health care reform plans, we would have to, it would add to the model, it would add many more elements to the model for the additional expenditure and provide then specific analysis of health care reform proposals. So that in essence describes what this bill is about.
Okay. And Senator Sharon, I know you've been working with Senator Pappas, Mr. Mossman, to incorporate some clarifying language. And you've also suggested the deletion of Subdivision 2 on page 2 because of some of the concern, as you mentioned, relative to the fiscal note process and how that's to be structured. Maybe I could ask Mr. Mossman to state the language that you've worked on with him.
Mr. Chairman and members, and most of this amendment, if you offered it, would be to bring the language into conformity with how it is largely in the omnibus bill now also. But it would be on page 2, line 14, subdivision 2, to strike subdivision 2, but to retain part of the concept of the availability of that, the intent of subdivision 2, by adding back on page 1, line 14, after the period, adding a sentence that reads, "The model shall be available to state agencies and the legislature."
So I would make that motion for Senator Sharon.
Okay, so Senator Berglund moves that amendment. Further discussion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
I'm sorry.
Before we vote, I'm sorry. Senator Higgins?
Mr. Chair, that sentence doesn't make it clear that the information that's gained from this could be used for the development of fiscal notes, though.
Right. That's the point.
Oh, and that's the point?
Yeah.
Oh, all right. Sorry. I think it's kind of valid that they could be used for fiscal notes. Should be a nice idea. Bring some reality into the world.
Okay. Senator Higgins has caught on. All right,
well, and Mr. Chair, I'm trying to catch on too here because I haven't heard this bill before. But the concept of having longer term costs and benefits accounted for in our budgeting decisions is such an important concept. And Senator Stumpf is gone, but in our education committee, we talked about that, and we talked about sort of the broader cost benefit of people dropping out of high school at age 16. And we got a fiscal note that showed it was a cost to the school systems or to the education system to take away that age 16 dropout law and allow them to or require kids to go to school till they graduate. And if you think about all the research that has been done, it's so clear that there's enormous cost savings to eliminate high school dropouts, you know, not eliminate them, to eliminate the possibility of dropping out of high school, and that it saves so much money. But that's never accounted for in our budgeting process, that there's actually a huge cost savings to require kids to graduate. And it's just not accounted for in any of our budgeting decisions, and it's really hard for the legislature to have that type of information in front of us to make really good long-term decisions. So I think it's a great concept that we really need to explore.
Mr. Chairman, on the same topic, Senator Anderson, it's even worse than that. Extending the dropout age to 18 is a cost to the state because we're paying per pupil cost for those kids who stay in school a couple extra years.
Right,
so
exactly.
You actually might have a fiscal note that says you have to come up with more money.
Mr. Chair, we
and
did.
You did.
That's the problem.
One conversation over there.
Rather ridiculous.
Our
fiscal note showed it would cost money to keep kids in school till age 18 when we know that it'll actually save so much money in so many different budgets, but that isn't accounted for in our fiscal note process.
Senator Sharon.
Thank you, Chairman Cohen. I think that the issue is that we have a two-year budget cycle that we're looking at, and that's what our committee was trying to get at, and we may still have to come back and look at this further in the future, but what we thought this tool would provide, and it doesn't mean that it can't be utilized in the process of thinking about budgeting and what goals and objectives we're trying to achieve, but it was an effort to try to say we can look at things for a longer period of time than just a two-year budgeting cycle. This would be able to cause us to see what some of the long-term impacts might be. And it's a part of what the healthcare reform process is about. We're anticipating over more than a two-year budget cycle, which the fiscal notes look at, what the healthcare savings would be in order for us to justify our current commitments in the budget.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman, and that's, you know, that's one of the wonderful and unique things that happened out of the Healthcare Access Commission and the healthcare transformation process was that we had the health economics unit in the Department of Health actually projecting things, you know, over a 5 or 6 year period of time in terms of what the impact of something would be, which we never get through the fiscal note process.
You know how to do that.
You know, another example would be when there are proposals to increase prescription drug copays in our public programs, the department will figure out then, you know, how much less they pay but they won't figure out that, you know, for some people that are on insulin, that's a weekly copay, and at the end of the month, these poor people, because they are poor in order to be on the program, don't have the copay, so they're not getting their insulin. And they don't figure out what the cost is then of low-income people who don't have their insulin being hospitalized or going into diabetic shock or anything like that. And we just need to do more of that. So I think, you know, Senator Sharon's bill is a really good step in that direction.
Okay, we have Sir Anderson.
Mr. Chair, I just have a question about on line, page 1, line 17, the language to enter into the model. And I that it's kind of making me think about an interactive video game. Is that what we're talking about?
It's sort of like that.
It's just strange terminology, and I'm not quite sure what that means.
Well, if you'd like to change it, you know, we had the amendment. I had suggested Senator Pappas, I believe, moves the amendment. Senator Berglund, did you?
Yes.
And we got sidetracked. So is there further discussion on the amendment?
Aye.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Okay, further discussion on the bill. Senator Anderson?
Mr. Chair, could we just change that to use the model? Would that work instead of entering into it, whatever that means?
No.
No?
It's a term of art.
It's an interactive.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right, Senator Sharon.
I don't think that that particular word would mm-hmm. be the correct change. It is a computer model in which they will enter data or questions,
access.
And it'll be an interactive process that can change based on assumptions.
Mm-hmm.
So,
Further discussion on Senate File 3573.
I'll move the bill.
All right. Senator Berglund moves that Senate File 3573, as amended, be recommended to pass. Senator Sharon, is there something else you wish to say?
Just a final statement. I really appreciated the discussion about the long-term, two-year fiscal policy analysis that's done in the long term. This issue is, I think, critically important, not just in this healthcare area, but in all of our areas of taking a look at the impact of what we're doing.
Yes.
We need to really address this in all our sectors, all of our sectors, not just in the area of healthcare.
Okay. Senator Berglund moves that Senate File. Thank you, Senator Sharon. Senator Berglund moves that Senate File 3573 as amended be recommended to pass. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion carries. Thank you very much, Senator Sharon.
Thank you very much.
Chairman.
Senator Metzen.
Senator
Metzen, before we adjourn, Senator Metzen moves reconsideration of the vote by which House File 3138 was recommended to pass. We talked about language relative to the legislative auditor. As it turns out, that's not in the previous bill. So we just want to add that language. I think Senator Betzel and Senator Metzen have talked about this.
I want to thank Senator Betzel for drawing this to my attention. It was inadvertently left out of another bill, and we thought, well, we better get it done here. So,
Senator Betzel.
This is a separate bill that Senator Metzen is carrying. It's been through the process. I think the bill is right now in the Finance Committee, so this is not a new issue. It just seems logical to bring them together here.
All right. So on the motion to reconsider the previous vote of Senator Metzen, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion carries. So we have House File 3138 in front of us again. Senator Metzen moves adoption of the A2 amendment we've just discussed. Now, it's been distributed. Further discussion on that amendment? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion carries. Then Senator Metzen moves that House